We were looking yesterday at the Council of Conscience, the council which was called for these three important purposes, and the purpose which was most important was to reform the church, of course. But that which was most pressing was to heal the schism. When you had three popes, each calling the other an apostate, a heretic, a wicked man, and so on, and the people, some nations supporting one, some the other, and some nations divided, you had a situation which everyone felt was intolerant. We noticed that as far as heresy was concerned, the council took very drastic action. This, I don't think, greatly affected conditions in England, because in England, the hierarchy was already well set against Wycliffe's fall. And it is true that during the next century, most of them were either cowed or were burned at the stake. And Lollardism, as it was called, the followers of Wycliffe, became a very small and insignificant feature in English life by the end of this present century. It's only because of the work of Martin Luther that the Reformation came, and when it did, people recognized that Wycliffe was indeed the morning star of the Reformation. As far as Czechoslovakia was concerned, the two great leaders, John Huss and Jerome of Prague, were both destroyed at the council, but their teaching remained dominant in Czechoslovakia for a period of 200 years. And then it was the force of the Austrian emperors, directed by the Jesuits, that overran Czechoslovakia, and in the course of the war, three-fourths of the people were killed or fled into other countries, and most of the buildings were destroyed. I was reading last night, somebody said that no country in the world had more beautiful churches, finer church structures than Bohemia had previous to 1600. But that as a result of all the destruction that ensued there, that practically all of them were destroyed, and he said were succeeded by the tasteless, hideous Jesuit churches, is the way this particular writer described it, that were built since, and that have covered that country. But Hussites became practically unknown in Bohemia, except that there was a very small group, maybe 2% of the country, that secretly maintained their faith for 200 years. And when, in the middle of the last century, an Austrian emperor took over who decided to give freedom, give a large measure of freedom to the people, there were a number of hundreds of these books that came out of hiding that had been hidden and studied by the families for 200 years. So as far as the council dealing with Bohemia was concerned, they destroyed the leadership there and they closed them off from other countries. So that while the teaching of Wycliffe had tremendous influence in Bohemia, it probably would have spread much to other countries if it was not for the action of the council. Then, of course, began at the end of the hour to look at their actions regarding the papacy. And under that, we saw, A, how John the 23rd, the man who represented the succession of the establishment by the Council of Pisa, the man who represented that succession papacy, which the Council of Pisa claimed to have deposed the other two popes. And the man who represented that succession had proven to be a man of such wicked character that everyone was convinced he must go. And though John the 23rd called the meeting, and it was supposedly under his authority that they started, except for those many leaders who said that they had authority as representing the whole church to go ahead without a papal sanction, they brought these terrible charges against him, and they deposed him on the ground of immorality, murder, and just about every crime you can possibly think of, most of which they could find good evidence of somewhere during his life. Then B is the Roman Pope. Yes? Yes. He's in prison for a time. But he did not enter into it before he died. He was given this good position, but he died just about ready to start in this good position. He was rather elderly anyway.
Well, I was wondering what the date. I think that More recently, the Roman Church has indicated that they dropped him from the list because of the last
John. Yes, now just a word on that. That is something that's good to have clearly in mind, the situation about that. According to the present theory of the Roman Church, the Pope is the head of the Church because he is the successor of Peter. And they say Peter was Bishop of Rome, and therefore whoever is Bishop of Rome is the head of the Church. And no one in the Church outside of Rome has any right to even say who it will be. It is the Bishop of Rome that is the head of the Church, according to them. Now, according to, in the early days, the Bishop of Rome was chosen by the congregation. And you remember how back in the time of Jerome, they had big fights sometimes over who would be bishop, and dozens of people were even killed in the fight, as two different factions opposed as to who would be the bishop. Well, during the Middle Ages, it got to be narrowed down that not the congregation, but the clergy would select. And theoretically, today, it is the clergy of Rome that selects the bishop of Rome, the clergy of Rome. And no one, according to theory, has any right to any voice whatever in it, except a member of the clergy of Rome. But the clergy of Rome came to be called cardinals. And then the popes in the early Middle Ages, wishing to honor some people from other countries, made them members of the clergy of Rome. And consequently, today, if you find, say, the Archbishop of New York is now to be made a cardinal, well, I don't know what his actual statement will say. But it will be something like this, that he is appointed by the Pope to be a deacon in a certain little church somewhere in Rome. Or maybe even a bishop of one of the suburbs. Or a priest. Some position in the clergy of Rome. And maybe once in 10 years he'll go and hold a service in that particular church in Rome. But the men who do the actual work in Rome are not theoretically members of the clergy of Rome at all. And so you see how the theory and the practice are completely switched in this case, just exactly as they have in the Electoral College in this country. For the Electoral College, according to the Constitution, picks the president, and yet when one of them wanted to vote for who he wanted to have as president, everybody said it was wicked, that he had no right to do it. Well, if they don't have a right to do what they're supposed to be elected to do, they ought to do away with the whole thing, of course. But here, the theory is one thing, and the practice is an entirely different thing. And that, in every institution, almost, that develops, things develop, that as conditions change, it is difficult to persuade people to make a complete change of terminology, arrangement, or organization or something, and it's much easier to keep old terminology and give new duties. And you'll find that in any monarchy, like in the British government, not the government, but in the theoretical government, that is the state of the monarch, you will find that somebody will be the lord of the bedchamber. And this will be a man of great prominence in the country, who is given this title as an honor. And probably it goes back to someone who originally made the bed 800 years ago, 900 years ago, and then it was given as a title of honor to somebody else. And many of your top officials have titles like that that have nothing to do with anything they actually do. It is much easier to switch duties and keep the same name than it is to make what is evidently a change. And most organizations find such things coming to pass. And when you find an organization that's existed for many centuries like this, you have now this situation where people are called cardinals, which means a member of the clergy of Rome who actually aren't at all. And the actual clergy of Rome, unless one of them happens to be a cardinal, are not theoretically clergy of Rome. And theoretically, the clergy of Rome elect the bishop of Rome. But then, in this theory, you got the situation in 1381, when the cardinals, most of whom were French, met in Rome and unanimously elected Urban VI, the bishop of Rome. And then when he began treating them in such a tactless manner, they went to another town, and there they unanimously elected a different man, and said they had elected him under pressure, and therefore that it was not valid. And so you have two men, each of whom has been elected by the same group of cardinals, and each of whom has been elected to them to be Bishop of Rome. Then you have the Council of Pisa, where some of both groups of cardinals met together. And they said, these men have forfeited their position by their citizens. And therefore, we are electing a new one, and they elected Alexander to be Pope. And theoretically, they were the clergy of Rome. Now then, during the schism, you had some countries said one man was the Pope, some said another was the Pope. They sent their taxes to him. They looked to him for decisions on important matters in the country. And Italy was divided, with parts of Italy recognizing one, parts of Italy the other. And during the years between the Council of Pisa and the Council of Constance in Italy, you had Gregory, they called the Roman line, coming to have very little of Rome in his hand. And John 23rd of Italy, John 23rd had most of Italy and had the city of Rome during a considerable part of this period, though he was driven out of it shortly before the Council of Constance. And so, as to the theory, who can say which one it is? And so, in subsequent years, different authorities took different positions as to who had been the true Pope during this period. And the usual custom was to say, well, the Avignon Popes, they weren't. They just ruled them off. One reason being, as we'll see a little later, that the Avignon Popes never submitted to the Council of Constance. They just ruled them out. They call them antipopes. But then the Pisa Pope, John 23rd, had held the greater part of Italy for quite a time. And it was he who called the Council of Constance. And consequently, it was customary in listing the Pope simply to say Roman line, Pisa line, and list the men from Urban VI on, and then to list the two men that Pisa Pope, and then to list the Avignon Pope as antipope, but thus to list the three of them. That was pretty much customary among Roman Catholic historians and ecclesiastical leaders until within the last century, when there was much argument about the infallibility of the Pope and so on, and it produced a rather awkward situation. We've had two real popes at once. And so the tendency in the last century has been to say the Roman line is the only line of true popes. And they are the true popes, and the other ones, the Pisa popes, are not popes at all. But you would have had among Roman historians some who would say John 23rd was a real pope, and some who would say he wasn't. But he was such a wicked man that it put such obloquy on the name of John that nobody took the name of John after his time for 500 years. And then 500 years later, the old man who was elected by the cardinals, was it 12 years ago, something like that, settled the matter with his infallible authority in a very nice way, a very clever way, instead of saying, these are who the popes are, and these weren't. He took the name John and added the number 23, thus saying, this John 23 wasn't a pope at all. And for people that know something about history, his action immediately says, this is the fact, this is what the Pope said. But for people who don't know anything about history, it doesn't raise the question and doesn't call attention to the fact that there was disagreement as to who was the true Pope or that John 23rd had been such a wicked man. It just pushes him aside and takes the same name and takes the curse off him. And it was a very, very clever thing. But he was a very great diplomat, as John was, a very experienced diplomat in many countries before he became Pope, and he evidently knew just what he was doing when he took this action. So up till 12 years ago, if you said John 23rd, you meant the man we've recently been speaking about. But now, of course, if you say John 23rd, you mean this recent man, and it pushes the other out of the line and makes it easier to forget that such a wicked man as he ever was considered as having really been a Pope. Yes? Yes. Another matter that has been greatly argued and discussed, and which we will look at a little more fully going on. Yes. And incidentally, this discussion, as much as this in answer to the question, was because it was very important related to the matter we're dealing with. And that's why I took so long on a particular question. it affects the whole principle, the whole matter. And this other does too, but we should be coming to that very quickly now. Now then, after John 23rd, the next one was the Roman Pope. And they call him the Roman Pope. They call him the Roman Pope, or the Pope of the Roman line. Not that he had control of Rome, because John 23rd had had control of Rome. But because he was the successor to Urban, the line that they called the Roman line. And Gregory XII, as they call him, Gregory XII had comparatively little power during his latter years. Most of Italy had been in the hands of John the 23rd. McSorley says about Gregory XII, he says that he was chosen chiefly because of the hope that he would end the system. As Pope, he renewed the oath he had taken as cardinal to abdicate if Benedict XIII would resign. That is, that was the Avignon Pope. But under pressure brought to bear upon him by his relatives and King Ladislaus, and contrary to his promise in the conclave, he created 10 new cardinals and pronounced Benedict XIII and Alexander V schismatic and perjurers. So this is the way McSorley presents the one he considers to have been the true Pope. He was an elderly man, a man who was not very successful, but who they claimed had the true succession. And it was not too hard to persuade him, when he was losing power anyway, had very little power actually now, to come to the council and there to abdicate. And at first he wouldn't come unless Benedict would come, and Benedict would abdicate too. And they went to Benedict, the Avignon Pope, and they tried to get him to. But when Gregory saw that he couldn't accomplish anything by holding out, he simply came to the council. And then when he came to the council, and he gave his blessing to the council and declared that this was an ecumenical council, and presided for a brief time, and then abdicated at the request, in fact, the demand of the council, he abdicated as Pope. And he says, McSorley says, after the Council of Constance assembled 1415, Gregory resigned and became Bishop of Porto. So that he resigned now in 1415. And there are those who say the Council of Constance was not a true council until Gregory came to it and gave it his authority. And then it became a true council. That is what some would say. Most would not say that, but some would say that. But Gregory then has resigned, and so from 1415 to 1417, there is John the 23rd is no longer Pope, Gregory XII has resigned, is no longer Pope, but there is Benedict XIII still claiming to be Pope. And so C will be Benedict XIII. I don't know if it's so important to you to remember the names of these latter two, Gregory XII and Benedict XIII, but remember the main facts about them as connected with the Pope of the Roman line or the Pope of the Avignon line. Now this man, the Pope of the Avignon line, Benedict the 13th, had been elected as Pope by the Avignon men quite a long time before him. He was an elderly man, and he had constantly said he was ready to resign when the Roman man would, but they never had gotten together. Each of them always put the blame on the other one. And now the French had turned against him. They had given their support to the Pisa Pope and now to the council, and probably because he wasn't a Frenchman after all. So he was theoretically of the Avignon line, and he saw that the French were going to take over control, so he had to flee from Avignon. After swearing he would stay there and continue in Avignon, he and this guy had fled from Avignon and gone to Spain. And being a Spaniard, the Spaniards stood by him during a substantial part of the council, but then came and were recognized as a fifth nation and given a vote in the council. But there in Spain, he lived in a castle, an impregnable castle that overlooked the Mediterranean Sea. And the representatives went to him there at this castle in a place called Peñascola. And they went to him there and tried to get him to come to the council. And he refused. He declared he was the Pope. And they, in trying to exert authority over him, were schismatics and were heretics and so on. And he stayed there until his death a few years later. And during that time, he kept launching his edicts of excommunication against everybody that didn't support him and issuing his terrible blasts against all the rest, but nobody paid much attention to him anymore. So that both Gregory and Benedict XIII had been theoretically deposed by the Council of Pisa, and now the Council of Constance declared Benedict deposed. And they would have declared Gregory deposed, but he resigned, as they wanted Benedict to do office. And so John 23rd and Gregory 12th were no longer recognized by anyone as Pope, and Benedict 13th only by a very few people. The Spaniards and the French recognized, gave their support to the Council of Constance. But for 2 years now, there was no one whom the council recognized as Pope. And the council proceeded with its deliberation. Emperor Sigismund wanted them to proceed to reform the church. He wanted them to proceed to make it clear what the authority of a council was and just what a pope was supposed to do, how much authority he had, and where his authority came to an end. He wanted them to take actions that would do away with simony, with absenteeism, with nepotism, with many of these things, that would make a higher standard of education, at least, for the clergy. All sorts of things which were recognized throughout Christendom by all intelligent people as being absolutely necessary if the church was to be, in any sense, a spiritual organization. But in the council, there was seemed to be quite a division over this. Everybody wanted reform. All agreed. Reform is necessary. Reform is desirable. The church must be reformed in head and in members. But some said the council should proceed to carry out thoroughgoing reform. They said the council represents the church. It is the These are the representatives of the church as a whole. The church as a whole has authority over the Pope, over all its officials. It should say what is to be done. And these were the men you call the conciliary. They held the theory of the supreme authority of the council. But there were others in the council who said, yes, we want reform. We want all these things reformed. But they said the church should be under control of the Pope. The Pope should be in control, and he should carry out the reform, and he should do this reform. And so they said, we should proceed to elect a Pope. And so for the next 2 years, the argument went on at great length. Which should we do first? Should we make definite reforms and carry them through, or should we elect a Pope who should carry through the reform? And eventually, those who wanted to have a pope elected first obstructed the others from taking any definite action in almost any direction of reform, because they said, fine, we're strong for it, but let's get a pope first who will do the reform. And eventually, they succeeded in persuading them that they should proceed to elect a pope. Now, when it came to electing a pope, there was a question. Who shall elect the Pope? And so we'll make, I think, this, the council's actions regarding the papacy was number 5. I thought of putting the new Pope under that, but I think maybe we'll make it number 6. Number 6, election of a new Pope. Election of a new Pope. How shall a new Pope be chosen? There are men whom Benedict, the Avignon Pope, had made cardinals. There are men whom the Roman Pope had made cardinals, and there are men whom the Pisa Pope had made cardinals. And most of these men of the two groups, and even some, quite a few of the Avignon Pope appointments, had come to the council and had given declarations of their loyalty to the council. and their desire to work with it, but the feeling they should be recognized as having very considerable authority. And so the question was, shall the popes who were appointed by the cardinals appointed by the Roman line elect a new pope? Shall the pope, all the cardinals here, elect a new pope? Or shall the council elect a new pope? And there was much discussion and debate, and eventually they decided to have the cardinals meet together, but to have them vote not as individuals, but according to nation. And then if they, if two-thirds of the nation agreed on a pope among the cardinals, then the matter was to be presented to the other people at the council. And the rest of the council would meet according to nations, and they would consider various men. And if you could get the same man chosen by the others, as by the majority of the nations, that was chosen by the majority of the cardinals of the various nations, then he was the one they would recognize as pope. And here there was one man who had a number of great advantages. He was a cardinal who belonged to the Roman family of Colonna, C-O-L-O-N-N-A. This Roman family of Colonna was an ancient family in Rome which had been wealthy, had held high positions in Rome, had been very prominent for centuries. C-O-L-O-N-N-A. And the Colonna family had a cardinal who was a man of great tact, great moderation, many said. He did not take strong stands on most issues, but he let everybody feel that he agreed with them pretty well. And he was a man who they all thought was a quiet, nice fellow who would be good to have as an executive to carry out what the council wanted done. And they asked him what if he would reform the church. Oh, yes, absolutely. Will he carry out the desires of the council? Oh, thoroughly. And he was required to make promises, to make binding promises to this effect before he became pope. Although after he did, he gave his infallible opinion that no one could bind the pope by any promises, and that any promises made before becoming pope are not binding on a man after he becomes pope. And for the next 200 years, every pope was required, every cardinal was required for the next 200 years when they had a meeting to elect a pope, to promise that he would work for reform and carry through definite things that all the cardinals felt were desirable. And every pope for the next couple of centuries promised that, every cardinal before he was elected pope, but everyone after he was pope decided there is no power binding on a pope except his conscience. And so these oaths never accomplished anything. But in this case, this Colonna cardinal was agreed upon. He was a man who had less enemies than any other prominent person who might be considered for the position. He had the prominence, being a member of this important Colonna family, he had the prominence, having been a cardinal of this family for years, he had the prominence that might be desired in a pope, that would give him prestige anyway, standing. And a man of that prominence would certainly need to be considered. And when they considered man who would seem to be worthy of consideration for such a position, he had less enemies than anyone else. In fact, he probably had no enemies when he became pope. And so Martin V became pope. And he was elected by them. He was installed as pope. Thousands of people were there. They had a great celebration. The schism is now over. There is now an established pope who has been chosen by a council representing all of Christendom. So the conciliarists who thought the council should be the authority were happy. Their theory was carried through. They had chosen the pope. But those who felt that the pope was a monarch responsible to no one but himself, they were happy because the cardinals had acted, even though the council also had acted, and the pope was recognized as the pope, the bishop of Rome, and as a result, the head of the church. Now, Martin, as soon as he became pope, he was a man of very considerable diplomacy. And he immediately removed some of the promises he had made. He said, we are going to reform the church. We're going to reform it in head and in member. We're going to do away with all of these abuses. But of course, we'll take time to consider each problem carefully and to do it just in a wise way. And the council said, the leaders of the council said, a council controls the church. And the Pope is just the administrative head and the executive officer. And so they said there should be another council meeting in 5 years. And then after that, there should be one in 7 years. And then after that, every 10 years right along, a council to decide the things important to the church. And Martin V gave a binding promise that he would call councils this way after he became Pope. And so everybody was very happy now that Martin, they had a true Pope. The schism was over. All the country, except of course Bohemia now, gave their allegiance to Martin V. Bohemia was standing by John Huss, and Martin proclaimed a crusade against Bohemia, and for the next 14 years they tried to conquer it, but they failed. But Bohemia was separate. The rest of Western Europe was loyal to Martin V. So that was strict election of a new pope. And then number seven will be a look at the most important of the purposes of the council, the one we have not yet looked at separately, that is the matter of reform, the question of reform. And on this question, Martin V, like many popes before him and many popes after him, made great promises. But the promises were carried out to a very slight extent. One thing that people objected to was nepotism, the putting in of members of one family. Martin very soon made other members of the Colonna family cardinals and gave them positions of importance. One thing they objected to was simony, the sale of church offices. Martin looked for means of increasing the income of the papacy and used all these things as had been done before. They wanted efforts to be made to improve the condition, the education of the local clergy and all that. Martin said, that's very important, but we have many very pressing things to do first. So he never got around to those things. And so, as far as reform is concerned, reform was a big thing. Many people talked about informing the council, but very, very little was done about it. And it's actually another century and a half went by before much was done about reform. When the Reformation started, there was a pope soon after the Reformation started. A man was elected pope who declared that the papacy, that the church is corrupt and heaven members need thoroughgoing reform. We are going to reform it very thoroughly. Pope Adrian said, we're going to thoroughly reform the church. But he said, this wicked monster, Martin Luther, should be destroyed. He said, you destroy him, and we will proceed to reform the church. Well, the Germans said, we think what you said is right, but you reform the church before you tell us to destroy Martin Luther. And Adrian was only pope about a year and a half before he died. Many said he was poisoned. And since that day, never since has a non-Italian been elected pope. But Adrian was very, very unpopular. I think he really did try to carry out reform in these matters. But after him, there were a number of years until finally the strength of Protestantism became so evident and so clear that the church had to either reform or disappear. And they did reform many of these abuses. And today, these abuses are hardly found in advanced nations. In more backward nations, some of them do exist in certain areas. But these particular things that were so obviously needing reform continued until 50 years or more after the Reformation began, and then were many of them taken care of. In what we call the Counter-Reformation, what the Roman Church calls they say revolution and reformation. They call that reformation in the church, which they say took place 50 years after Martin Luther. So now the question of reform then was a question which everybody was interested in, which they wanted progress made, but again, the problem was what everybody's business is nobody's business. And the way to carry it out, to get all these people from all over Europe, they'd stay there 4 years having these problems. To get them to stay long enough to go into all these matters would just be impossible. They were in a hurry to get home. They should, of course, have developed some sort of a system where they would have a continuing smaller body with authority to handle them. But in short of that, they had to be done either by the executive or not at all. And Martin may have sincerely wanted to do that, but he had other things he wanted to do much more. And one of those things that Martin wanted to do was to bring back the prestige of the papacy, the prestige of Rome, to restore Rome, which had fallen into pretty bad shape. And he set to work very intelligently on some of these lines. And it took him a year and a half to get to Rome after he left the council, because there was so much strife and division and the groups in Rome that we didn't want him in there. But eventually he got into Rome, which during the schism and the Avenian, Babylon captivity, as they call it, had fallen into a state of disrepair and terrible condition. The city was almost a ruin. But Martin set to work rebuilding and restoring Rome's prestige and its standing, and it was like a new birth for the city. And he, of course, was a Roman and greatly interested in the welfare of Rome from a material viewpoint, and made tremendous strides in that direction. Now, the one thing I'm a little uncertain whether to discuss under this head, I think I will make a separate heading E, the end, the failure, we'll call it, the failure of the conciliar movement. The failure of the conciliar movement. Now, perhaps that's a little strong title, because the council did end the schism. It did restore the prestige of the papacy. It restored the strength of the organization. It did that. But many of the leaders of the council, many of the leading scholars and thinkers of Europe, had come out very strongly for the theory that the church is controlled by a council, and the Pope is simply executive officer of the council. And that was undoubtedly the view of the majority of the Council of Constance. But, and it was so strong that Martin had to promise to have a new council after 5 years, another after 7, and then every 10 years thereafter, a council. But when you have people scattered all over Europe desiring a council, but having their own living to make, having their own relations to their own countries to take care of, having their own local situations to handle, and desiring counsel, and desiring that counsel shall control, but every one of them, no one of them is at his livelihood. Every one of them has his own local situations, which have to take the major place in his thought and in his activity. And on the other hand, you have a Pope who has a position and a prestige and a standing which can be menaced to some extent by the calling of councils, and who therefore would like to have the councils rather disappear. The Pope has all the advantage. And so while Martin promised to do this, he never actually denied that he would do it, yet he and his successors very cleverly handled things in such a way that it was not long before the idea that there should be councils disappeared. And as you know, between the Council of Trent in about 1550 and the Vatican Council in 1870, I don't believe there was any council at all, I recall. If there was, it was only one or two very minor things. I'm not sure there was any. The papacy regained its strength. Now let me read you what McSorley said about Martin V. Now this is written from the viewpoint of the present Romanist church, or the church of maybe 15 years ago when he wrote. He says, Martin V, elected at the Council of Constance, received immediate recognition as a promising leader of the reform movement, and the able cardinals he appointed helped to end the schism. In accord with the decrees enacted at Constance, Martin negotiated concordat with Germany, England, France, and Spain, covering their questions of appeal to Rome, the proclamation of indulgences. They had made him promise that he would not sell indulgences except on very rare occasions. That it would not, it had been carried to a great extreme by some of the free-treating men, that they would not do much of that. Anti-papal laws were abolished, both in France and England. Alarmed at the spread of the Hussite heresy in Bohemia, Martin also published a bull calling for a crusade against heresy, but it evoked little response except from Emperor Sigismund. As the conciliar movement still had many adherents, Martin hesitated to convoke another assembly, McSorley says, which might undertake to modify the constitution of the church, which means which might undertake to carry on what the majority thought was the constitution. But he says to modify the constitution of the church. Nevertheless, because of the decree of Constance calling for frequent councils, he finally agreed to summon a council to meet at Pavia in 1423. See, that would be 5 years after the council Constance ended. But England and France were at war, Germany was engaged with the Hussite rebellion, Spain was fighting the Boers, and few bishops assembled. And then a plague broke out, and so he transferred it to another city. Transferred to Siena. Because of the plague in Pavia, the council soon manifested its antagonism to the monarchical constitution of the church. And in March 1424, the Pope made the small number of bishops present an excuse for dissolving the assembly. Now you notice, McSorley says he made it an excuse. And while his whole tone is, the constitution is monarchical, the Pope has a supreme power, you notice that he recognized that it was an excuse, that he was moving away from what most of the leaders thought was desirable, what he had even promised to do. But then he continues, he says, unfortunately, Martin failed to carry out the reforms announced in his bull of 1425, and various abuses continued in Rome. The list of disreputable persons on the ecclesiastical payroll included Poggio, the papal secretary, whose writings mocked both church dignitaries and the church itself. Another council soon became due, and under pressure, Martin appointed Cardinal Cesarini to preside over a council in Basel in 1431. The Pope died before it assembled. His reorganization of the papal states, although skillfully and successfully accomplished, was to a great extent nullified in subsequent pontificates. So you see how the conciliar movement was not defeated in a direct attack, but it was simply shunted aside and gradually moved out until the theory of the Roman Church during the past some centuries has been the Pope is the supreme monarch with absolute power and absolute control, and the council has no right to do anything except advise. And in this last session of the Vatican Council, when Pope Paul VI was there, he was very gracious and very diplomatic and said he'd like to have a council of bishops to meet with him and make recommendations. And they even passed a statement saying how the power of the church is in the hands of the bishops of the church who are united as the authority in the church. But these statements, the council spent weeks, in fact, some cases months, debating to get the phraseology exactly what they wanted. And then, a few days before the end of the council, when they had debated and discussed and had got the terminology just as they wanted to have it, they gave it to the Pope to have it printed and submitted for final vote. And the Pope, by his infallible authority, made about 15 changes in it. And in this one, which spoke of the authority of being in the bishops who are united, as they stand unitedly as the heads of the church, he inserted, and the head of the bishops is the Pope, and it is, of course, impossible that the bishop shall take any action except as its head shall dictate. And he put in a few statements like that, which made very clear that he adhered to the thoroughgoing monarchical theory of the papacy, and that whatever concessions were made were concessions of form and appearance or of additional counselors rather than of actually giving them, recognizing them that they had a right to any power or authority in the church. And some of them were very indignant at what he did. But He did it so cleverly. He let them argue and discuss and debate the thing all they wanted, and then when it was all done, he put this in. And they didn't want to stay another 6 months and continue to debate it. They passed it the way it was now with his changes introduced. So that actually no change has been made in the theory of the church. As far as the theory is concerned, it stands the same, but there's a lot of beautiful verbiage which some can take out and make a stand on it for something else. And actually, it's really due to modernism coming into the church more than anything else, that today the Pope is faced by groups who differ hardly at all from thoroughgoing Protestant modernists, who are very influential in the church. And in facing these, he is in a very difficult situation. And he has had time and time again to modify his stand on matters. Not because he believes they have any right to any authority, but because he simply hasn't the power to force them. And so he is at present in a very precarious position, but he is holding the same theory. Now, the failure of the conciliary movement was not simply manifest by this time, when this council of Pavia, after 5 years, was disposed of in this nice diplomatic way by Martin. He called another one for Basel. And this council that met at Basel held a number of sessions, did a good many things, and actually became disgusted at the new pope and ordered him deposed and elected one of their own. But the new pope who succeeded Martin V was a clever man like Martin had been, and managed eventually to put an end to the Council of Basel so that it really didn't accomplish anything. But it took a period of some years to do it. And if he'd been a man like Urban VI, they would have had another schism on their hands. But they had a group of popes now who were men of cleverness, of tact, men who knew what they wanted, and pushed it through effectively and decisively. And this Council of Basel is not nearly as important to the Council of Constance, but yet it is certainly interesting and worth our knowing about. And I think it's a better place to stop right here and discuss it tomorrow. So we'll look at the Council of Basel tomorrow.